Hi everyone, I'm Aaron Noonan. Welcome to the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Timken, a world leader in bearings and mechanical power transmission products and services. Now this week's guest took a bit of cajoling, but we finally got him to agree and come on and tell his story, which is a bit of a turnaround for him actually when you think about it, since he's usually the one asking people to tell their stories to him. If you've watched any motorsport on Australian TV in the last two decades, from V8 Supercars to Formula One and MotoGP, you are guaranteed to know his voice, and he's one of the nicest guys in the industry to boot. Yes, Greg Rust, Ruster himself, joins us on the V8 Sleuth podcast. Now, in the first part of our chat, Rusty talks about how he went from working in banking to a career in the media, his time courting Super Touring 2-litre touring cars, and working on the early years of Channel 10's V8 Supercars coverage. And he tells a few cracking stories about Barry Sheen and Lee Diffie. And we go all meta as he talks about his podcast on our podcast, telling the story of how his show Rusty's Garage came to be. Stay tuned for the second part where we ask him your National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions and he tackles our Motor Focus Top 10 shootout. So, here we go. Buckle up and make sure that the steering wheel is firmly affixed to the column. You know what I'm talking about, Greg, because it's time to start part one of Greg Rust on the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Timken. Greg Rust is in the house. We've tried to do this for so long. We have finally got you here.
I've ducked and dived, haven't I? I'm sorry.
You are like a prize boxer that's trying to avoid getting punched in the face. You have successfully done it, but today
you've
is
nailed
the day.
It. You've nailed it. I get very nervous about doing this stuff. I've done it on a handful of occasions. You know me. My philosophy is very simple. It's about the driver, the team, whatever. But yeah, it's nice to come along and chat about some stuff from years gone by.
Today, it is all about you.
No.
Well, mostly about you. We have had an amazing response to our National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions, which is basically Q&A.
Lovely.
You've called and pit reported many a top 10 shootout, but today you are in the top 10 shootout.
Holy hell.
It's our Motor Focus top 10 shootout. That's coming up a little bit later, which is just fancy word association.
Okay.
So you will think of the first thing that comes in your brain.
My limited grey matter.
And you let it blurt out your mouth. Okay. So just do what David Reynolds does.
Okay.
Yeah, just let it fly.
Left a field, turn hard right. Yeah.
Exactly. Yep. What could possibly go wrong? Mm. One of the things that when we do these podcasts, and I'm sure you do it with yours, is you sit down and do some research. I know that's an amazing concept because lots of other people don't.
Yes.
But when I look at Wikipedia, it worries me to think who's doing these pages, who's writing this stuff.
For a starter, my middle name is not Charles.
First question was going to be that.
It is not Charles.
Who put that there and why?
I have no idea. Every once in a while I get a random tweet of some kind, you know, which I think – you know, when you think about that stuff, you think, oh, I wonder if that's the person who's really done it and they're trying to get a bite out of me. But, yeah, someone's had some fun with it over time. Apparently, it's Gregory Charles Rust or something at the moment. That is not my nickname, my middle name.
Can you, for the record, state your full name?
Paul. Gregory Paul.
Okay.
And I only get Gregory if I'm in deep shit, usually with my wife or my mother.
Earlier in the year, we jump around on this podcast. I don't follow the timeline or the chronological unfoldings because I usually find a tangent and run down it. One of the things that Jason Barguana told us on the podcast earlier in the year was how he convinced the bank to give him a loan for a race car when he told them it was for a ute. He went and showed him the ad. Did you or did you not work in a bank for a while?
I did. Correct.
But did you deal in lending at all?
I did. Correct.
Did you deal in lending to Jason Barguana
not
at all?
Not to Jason Barguana.
Oh, okay.
No.
We were two out of three there,
Our paths did cross during that period, though.
Right.
So, basically, fresh out of high school with ANZ on like a cadetship program, got into some home loan and small business lending for them.
Did you have a name badge?
I had a name badge back then. It was horrific. I even appeared in like an internal staff training video for them. It's one of the first things I ever did
on television. I want to get a copy of this.
My hairdo was so bad and it was crap overacting. But anyway.
Nothing's changed.
No. But the moonlighting kind of started on weekends, and he would rock up to Oran Park with, I want to say, a white Kingswood or something like that with a Formula V or something on the trailer, and they were real early days of him around truck racing. That was one of the first times I came across him. And I've got, in the office or the garage at home. I've got a great photo of he and I at Oran Park. We look so ridiculously young. I know this will shock you. I'm overdressed with a tie and trying to look professional and interviewing him on the Oran Park podium. And he's in this like plain white race suit. That were the early days. Yeah.
Things stepped up just a little bit for both of you in the aftermath of that. So when did you break free of the banking world? And where did, probably rewind, where did the racing bug? And this is, does this feel weird that the questions you normally ask people are now being asked of you?
Absolutely. So when I left high school, so I mean, straight away, I...
Were you any good at school?
I was average.
Okay, you did enough to get by.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Some of my best mates and I went thirds in a club car.
Oh, what was it?
So it was a 1978 Mitsubishi Galant. We had a worked Sigma engine in it, 2.2, twin 45mm Webers, sports exhaust with extractors, a Bond roll cage, back in the old days of, not now, not in the way they're constructed now. But we did a few things to make it multi-purpose. So it had a Halder in it so we could do rally sprints.
Yep.
Did some lap dashes at Oran Park and Amaru. I loved Amaru. It was just a great learning experience, mate. So when people talk about that now, I'm a big advocate for go and do that stuff. Go and get a license. Do some club level stuff because it's a great rounding thing. I was dead set average, but it did taught me a lot. And I did a bit of karting as well. I had a supercart, a Tony kart with an 80cc Yamaha YZ80J engine. Dad would come and crew for me. Those carts you could run at Eastern Creek, Oran Park, Amaru. I took it to a couple of other places. But it was great. Little shifter cart, 80cc engine. And that came about through the banking. One of my clients at the time ran a workshop. He had a 250 and used to run in the 80s and away it went, mate. Yeah.
So did you ever have to fill out your own loan paperwork for a cart or a car?
I reckon I did some of that stuff, but it was approved. But it was approved by someone, not by me.
Oh, I thought we were going to get something sus.
The link between that and commentary is when I left ANZ, I went and worked for a couple of boutique lenders in the city in Sydney, where I was at the time. And one of them was down at Circular Quay, right on the waterfront. And the boss that I had at the time loved motorcycles. He would go to the Grand Prix at Phillip Island every year, and he'd heard me doing a bit of moonlighting. And he said to me, "You should pursue that." And so I had this sort of supporter in the background, and he kind of half put it to me. He said, "Mate, why don't you do a thing where you come and work a handful of days a week for me? You know, Tuesday to Thursday type deal, almost like a freelancer." Put a bit of money in your back pocket and go and chase the thing on weekends. And I did that. 12 months later, I was walking into his office and he said, "Just go and enjoy." Like he knew that it had gone to a point where
it
was on its way. There's still a lot of hard work involved, but I've touched base a little bit with him in years since, but there are a few little sliding doors moments like that, mate, where someone's been in your corner and gone, "You should give that a crack."
We've had numerous people on this podcast last year and this year, and everyone has that turning point moment and the people who help you get there, or the person that cracked open a door or gave you a little opportunity or saw a little bit of something or pushed you in a direction or made an introduction. There's numerous numbers of those people for everybody along the way. But one of the things you've always talked about is the 96 Australian Motorcycle Grand Prix. And you're smiling at me as I mention it. So at that time, it wasn't at Phillip Island. It was actually at Eastern Creek.
Eastern Creek,
it was about to head back to Phillip Island. So at the time, of course, Channel 9 were, you know, Formula 1 wasn't even MotoGP then, was it? It was 500cc Grand Prix racing.
Yep.
And you get the call up
to
work on the Channel 9 coverage with, you know, Darrell Eastlake's around, Barry Sheen's around.
Alan Jones
is around.
Yeah.
This is big ticket. So you'd been doing Speed Week.
A bit of Speed Week and lots of PA-based commentary. Diff and I would do a thing where we would share jobs too. So Lee Diffy and I are great buddies and talk every week.
Did that start around this time?
It started probably around then, maybe a little bit earlier, maybe a year prior. Daryl Beattie and he are very close high school buddies, and Lee had been working away with dirt track motorcycle stuff, and I think Daz had recommended Lee. He hadn't pushed him into it, but he'd recommended them, and so the connection started. So Yeah, he would, you know, if an opportunity came up for him and he didn't want to let down someone with, yeah, so he'd say, "Hey, Rusty, can you cover?" and vice Campbell, versa. Yeah. And we would do that stuff. He would come to my place, stay in the spare room on a fold out bed, or vice versa. You know, I got to know his family exceptionally well. They were the early years where you're doing it tough and you drive long distances. I would go sometimes I covered for him once at Ballina, doing dirt track motorcycle racing. So I drove 9 odd hours from Sydney to there, called 100 odd races over the PA, came back again. It's one of the first times I came across Casey Stoner. I went to Tamworth to a thing called the Akubra Nationals. Mate, if he wasn't racing, he was a little tacker, a real little tacker. If he wasn't racing in 5 classes that weekend, I'll give it away. And you knew even then, this kid is special. I mean, he just hung off the motorcycle unlike others. He did things on it that made you realise he had, you know, a huge amount of talent. So yeah, that were the early years. And dad was in hydraulics. He was the managing director of a company with about 60 staff. My grandfather was in the rag trade, and I thought they both wanted me to go into business. Not that I professed to being a great business person. And I was dead set nervous about telling Dad that I was half thinking about this media thing. And he couldn't have been more supportive, mate. He said to me, I don't want you to be 60 on the front porch going, "If only." So go and give this thing a real good crack.
And he had a way of getting free tickets to the races. That's the only reason why my dad liked me, working in motorsport media. That's pretty much the way. Well, I was 16, so I needed a ride. So he gets a ticket, I get a ride. Everyone,
he's a good fellow, your dad.
Yeah. Everyone won. Take me back to that 96 Grand Prix. So what were you calling? 125s or something? Superbikes?
Support categories mainly. That was a huge weekend, mate, because a lot of the track commentary in Sydney was largely run back then by either David Tapp or the late Greg McShane.
That's right.
And they coordinated a lot of that stuff. And McShane said to me, "Mate, I'm busy. I'm going to introduce you to Ingrid Ropers and the guys from, I think, IMG. They're looking for someone to put together the circuit commentary. Could you coordinate it?" And so I took that on board. I'd never done anything like that before, and there's lots of learnings in all of that. And at the same time, I think it was Mike Williams, who was the head of sport at Channel 9 at the time, got in contact and said, "We're looking for someone to do some support category stuff." And I was chuffed. I thought, this is a great opportunity. So I went to Willoughby in Sydney. Back then, Wide World of Sports was in a house attached to the whole Channel 9 precinct. I met him. I met Darrell Eastlake, and away it went. And Eastlake was exceptional to me.
I wanted to ask you about him.
Yeah, it was a very brief encounter with him in many ways. Lee Diffie stayed in touch with him right the way through. Big Daz, I can remember, he goes, "Hey, pal, come in. You can use my microphone and my headset." And I'm thinking, far out. I'm sitting in Darrell Eastlake's chair here to call these support races. "Now, you better do a sound check, pal." So I put the headphones on. And, I nearly went deaf. It was no wonder he was booming in that commentary style that was very unique to him back then, because his effects were so loud in the ear. I had to turn it down. It was
blow your ears out.
Yeah. So I got to meet Baz for the first time. Crazily, Alan Jones and I worked together for the first time that weekend, and then years later would end up together at Channel 10. So he and I did supercarts, and I think the late Ken Wooten and I did the 250 proddies and things like that. So yeah, it was a great intro to that whole world and how it operated with producers and just how next level TV land was.
Probably the first thing that a lot of our listeners will remember, the really in-depth ones might remember that. They might also remember Speed Week, but it's probably Super Touring that really started to kick things along. So. Yep. Very different media world back then to what we have now, where everything's live and everything's accessible and you've got Twitter for the latest news and all sorts of things. In those days, not even V8 Supercars was live when it went to 10. Super Touring was a week later, post-produced, so it was cut together and edited really well by people who we still work with, the Jardines, Tim and Fran Jardine and their team that were involved in all of that. And that's probably where I think a lot of people first started to see you in the chambray shirts and the bad 1997 type styling. But tell me about that Super Touring era, because it was a great little era of a time when V8 supercars were starting to grow and evolve. 2 litre was doing its thing. Yes, there was the wars and the Bathurst dramas and all that sort of stuff. But that's kind of the platform that you sprungboard from with that style of racing.
I wince now when I look back at some of that stuff. I know you do. I will be for whatever it takes, mate. Whatever it takes in terms of
invoice.
A great opportunity.
And was that through because Diffie had been doing it and moved on?
He couldn't, just say hi, this bloke. But I think in the background, he certainly did say at least consider this guy. So I can vividly recall going to meet now the late Mike Ordsent over at Channel 10.
Who was the head of sport?
He was the head of sport at the time. Yep. And he had – I'd put together a folder and some photos and a little CV of sorts.
A VHS as well, maybe.
And yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's nice. Right. Would have had some Speedweek stuff in it probably. And I'd done maybe one job for Channel 10 that was powerboat-based. So I think Mike had seen a little something. Anyway, met with him. It went well. He referred me to Tim and Fran Jardine, who you brought up before, who I've been working for on and off now for 23 years. They'd worked with Diff prior to that. It was very much modelled on the British Touring Car Championship coverage. It was really slick, really good. Great learning environment for me with good people. I would pair in that first year. I think it was with Murph and...
I've got my years wrong. So 1997 was the first year.
Andy Raymond
was briefly involved for a few rounds. Mark Fogarty was involved there for a little while as well.
Now you're showing that I can't recall stuff.
But Murph came along. It was the You and Murph show the next year in 98, if I remember.
That's right. Mm. So the link I'm bringing up here with Andy Raymond, he and I went to the same primary school in Sydney.
Really?
So
he was at the same time?
He was 1 year below me. Where I used to live where I was growing up in Sydney at the time, the Raymonds were in that area. Andy, I can always remember Andy rocking up to school because he was doing BMX back then, and they had a BMX track at Liverpool Speedway and things. And he had either a Kurahara or a Mongoose BMX bike, and I used to look at that thing and go, man, that's the dream machine. I want one of those things. So here, I mean, he's gone on to do some awesome stuff at Fox now. He and I got to work together, which I thought was really cool. I don't think I was great at it to begin with.
Because that was a calling role, wasn't it? It's very different when you post-produce commentate. And when we talk about post-production, so in essence, what the racing's occurred on one weekend, the editors have gone away, they've cut it all together to make it look the best it can look. You can make a bad race look good or a good race look great.
Yep.
But then as the commentator, you're rolling in the next week or the next weekend or whatever it is, and commentating a race you already know what happens in and how it happens and what happens to who. So the great skill is kind of to not be too presumptuous, but to also not appear to be completely oblivious.
That's right.
And to make it fit a hole because an in-car camera pops up or a cut to an interview or a whatever it is. It's actually a really
difficult thing to do
to get your head around because it's like constantly having a time gun at your head going, 23 seconds here, now talk. Yep. 10 seconds here, now talk. 5 seconds. No, not 5.1, 5. It's actually really hard to do.
The line between where you're going here, between spontaneity and
it's hard.
Being informative / authentic, it's not easy to do. So I learned a lot in that period. And a lot of it was to do with just being kind of comfortable in your own skin. You don't need to act that stuff out. You don't need to. The more natural you can be, and that comes with time because you're on camera. You're just being a bit more relaxed about it over time. That changes things. Yeah.
What's the standout memory from that little super? It was only a couple of years. Actually,
I went. You'll love this.
Yeah. We want dirt.
So, Timmy Jardine was always thinking cutting edge, whether it's graphics, music.
And he runs a production company in Sydney called Z Space, which we should mention. And they've been around the sport for a very long time. They produced the big screen at the Melbourne Grand Prix and in Singapore as well. But in that era, they were doing super touring. Just to put a bit of background around who Tim is and where he fits in the pictures.
So he says to me at one stage, we'd love you to host the opening in car with Brad Jones at Phillip Island in the Audi. And I said, that'd be awesome. Like, just, you know, here am I trying to memorize lines and things, but really I was just excited about going for a ride in this race car. So Bardley gives it heaps. And away we go. We're all mic'd up, wired up, and we were coming over the top of Lukey down into MG corner, and he spun it. So we had to do a take two, and I've wound him a couple of times about that in the years gone by. So there's some great things that we were able to do, even though it was post produced. And a lot of those learnings still serve me to this day, I reckon.
Mate. We will find that tape.
Don't.
No, for him, not for you. Yeah. We'll get back to the podcast in just a moment. But I wanted to tell you about our good friends at Timken, a world leader in bearings and mechanical power transmission products and services. Now, you might know their name and recognise their logo, but did you know that Timken products have been to the surface of Mars? It's true. Timken partnered with NASA to design and develop bearings for its Mars rover missions Spirit, Opportunity and Curiosity, as well as for NASA's next scheduled mission to the Red Planet that's set to blast off in July 2020. The Curiosity rover used Timken bearings in its descent to the planet, as well as in the carousel system that positions the rover's sample cups for gathering and analysing rock, soil and atmosphere, plus two bearings that run the vacuum pump that supports the rover's analytical equipment. Those bearings are just 6.35 millimetres, yes, millimetres in size, and they rotate at 100,000 RPM. It's amazing. We'll bring you some more cool facts about Timken in each episode of the V8 Sleuth podcast this year, but now it's back to the podcast. So at that time, V8 Supercars had just gone to Channel 10 yep. after many, many years on 7.
Yep.
The Super Touring stuff was being broadcast on 10, in essence, supplied to them by a production company. But, of course, Super Touring was becoming Bathurst for the traditional Channel 7
yep.
1,000K race. Do you remember the political gunfight at the time being pretty good, or did you have to keep it? It didn't really affect you?
Well, because in 98, an opportunity opened up to do some pit reporting for the supercars.
For the Enduros?
For the Enduros, yeah. That's right. So that was a delicate path to walk along. And then it came to a point where I kind of had to make a choice really about which way I was going to go with it. And the other part, mate, that was hard in all of that is that you know, Johnny Smales was pit reporter in 97. And I'd had some dealings with Will Hagen with the bike GP, and I was very conscious of those guys being, you know, like a generation prior and being very respectful. And, you know, I effectively took over from Smalesy in the pit reporting role. So that was, you know, that was tricky. But to this day, with both of them, I have an excellent relationship. And the learning for me with them was about always trying to, with young guys like you, Richard Crail, you know, Matt Nolte, whoever, was always working with them. I didn't want to put a border up type deal.
So someone's going to find a way to.
Yeah, but it's just life. It's just life, mate. You know, people will get that opportunity, and they rightly, if they've done the hard yards, they rightly should get that opportunity. Mm. So, it opened my eyes to. I can remember I'd been with AJ at Channel 9 not more than whatever it was 2 years prior, and on the grid at Sandown in 98, something happened with his Falcon. I want to say
about 3 meters. Yeah, and it blew the rear end out. Yeah,
exactly,
like that.
Exactly. Yeah. So I get dispatched to go and interview him. And he was bright red, and he just gave it to me. It was like, you can F off, you know, if you think, you know, da-da-da-da. And I was like, where's the guy I was commentating
I thought
with?
We were just good.
Yeah, correct. And you know who solved it for me? Baz. Baz walked straight up me, go, AJ, just take it easy, mate. He's just doing his job, right? You know, like, and he completely smoothed the waters. And AJ was, you know, it was just in the heat
you
of the moment.
You just got him on the wrong time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So that was now. We're long beyond working at the bank.
Yep.
So we are now full time with Channel 10 at this point. Or are you still doing other things to keep yourself busy?
I think I stopped doing the finance stuff when I largely committed to Super Touring. So in 97, what I was juggling with then, which was again another great learner and you know, something to help shape you as a broadcaster. David Tapp at the time was the head of sport at 2GB in Sydney. Mm-hmm. So I was super touring on, you know, certain weekends, which he was more than happy for me to go off and pursue. The rest of the time I was doing reading sport news for them, occasionally some around the grounds rugby league reporting and AFL and other bits and pieces. I can recall my old man ringing me at one point in time. His best mate in Sydney had been listening to 2GB, and he rang Dad and he says, "What the hell does Greg know about rugby league?" So there's all of that stuff. And by the end of the tenure that I had with GB, it sort of all lined up, mate. I ended up starting at 10 in 2000, and I was there for whatever it was, 14 years with them. But with GB, in the end, I was reading daytime news for them. I worked with some terrific people. The head of news now at Channel 7, Jason Morrison, David Spears, Paul Murray. I mean, all of those guys were in the office then, and to learn from them, it was exceptional. Yeah.
Is that we give you shit all the time about your broadcasting voice and your very straight delivery sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it the background in radio and the voice training that you had back in the day what creates that, you think?
A bit of that. I try and
be more natural. You have a bloody good sense of humor. Yeah. We just need to keep needling you all the time.
Yeah, to do it rather than being so serious. Yeah. I'm a serious cat by nature, mate. I'm very mindful of the fact that it's someone else's train set. I want to do a good job with it. I'm making a contribution to it. I'm fundamentally a worker, not a I hate
diva.
I don't like that shit, mate. I really hate it. And to this day, all the people behind the scenes, I can nearly name them all, you know, from you know, the team in audio to those that work in the truck, they're friends, they're proper friends. Mm. So yeah,
you mentioned just quickly before about 2000, and that's when the 10 thing starts.
Yep.
So this is one thing I've always wanted to sit down and talk to you about, because I don't think I ever really have, whether it's a microphone or not a microphone. So in 2000,
yep,
you get the gig as the voice of V8 Supercars on the 10 network. You are the commentator along with, I think, Mark Osler was in the box with
Baz.
You, and Baz was around at the time, and of course. Cromley was racing. He was with Ford Tickford for Glenn Seaton at the time.
Yep.
So you've got the Holy Grail gig here.
Yeah.
Do you remember the phone call, the meeting, the whole, righto, mate, you're in?
Yeah,
do you remember that vividly?
Yeah, I do. I can recall even David White, my boss at the time. He mate, has been my best boss
of all
time.
We need to get him on this podcast.
Yeah, he's a terrific.
When he's in the country next.
You know, I can even recall him eyeballing me saying, "You got your work cut out for you, Gregory, but it's a great opportunity." Kind of grab it with both hands. He was an awesome boss because, as you know, mate, he properly understood motor racing. He'd worked his way through television from we went once on a trip to the Nürburgring, and we did some stuff for RPM and the like, and he came with us. And he took a camera and went out and filmed some stuff for us for a story on one of the corners. David White was physically
there. He's the head of sport.
He's the head of sport at the time.
And he's out there on
camera. He was just into it, absolutely into it. He had an SLR 5000 that you'd have to ask him this on your podcast here, but its lineage or its heritage, I think, was an early test mule for
the dealer team
or something. Yeah. So they did a lot of homework on that, and Gary Rogers did a great resto on it. So, I mean, to have him, A, excellent television knowledge, B, proper motor racing knowledge, that's, you could argue that's good and bad. The great thing about it was that, you know, in a motor racing sense, he only wanted to showcase it the best way possible, but you couldn't sit back on your laurels. So I can recall the phone call, yes. Largely dealt with Mike Ordsent in the early part of that. And it opened up a whole world of things for me. It also was a great life learner, mate. There was a couple of moments there that were, you know, I didn't do a good enough job with some things, I don't think.
What things?
Well, I mean, if you look at the fact that at the end of 2000, it you know, I'd called Bathurst and I'd had a big year there. Cromley's life was, in a racing sense, was changing. So I kind of stepped out of that role into a pit reporting role for 2001, and ironically, I found a little home for myself. You know, so I had to have an awkward phone call with David White about that. And
in essence, you're being moved.
Pretty much, yeah.
Because Cromley had left Glenn Seaton's team
to
sign with Gibson Motorsport with Craig Lowndes. However, the plan was two cars, but they didn't have two cars.
Yeah, and you couldn't have a guy like him on the sidelines, mate. That's you know, he's just too good. You need him involved in the broadcast in some way. So I'm a huge believer in life. When those things happen, A, what is the contribution that you made to it? Bit of navel gazing. And secondly, It's all about how you deal with it. You know, if you can just keep focusing on the negative or what's gone wrong, but I'm eyes forward. I just wanted to grab the pit reporting thing, some RPM stuff, and you know, I did things like you know, I pull some 24-hour shifts on occasion for RPM. I just immersed myself in it. So it taught me a lot. A few crazy things happened in that period as well, like 9/11.
I was going to talk to you about that. Yeah, that's on the list.
Yeah, I'm jumping around here.
No, that's what we do on this pod. But what did you take away and go, right, I'd have done that different, I'll do that better.
Yep.
That was pretty good.
Yep.
What did you take away? I mean, this is 20 years ago,
20 years ago,
scary.
Yeah. I just I'm not great with politics. I don't do politics. I'm a worker, right? And to a fault. To a fault. You do need to have a bit of that nous, that awareness. In you know, it's a tough game. It is a tough game. But if you're not prepared to play hard and to work hard, then you shouldn't be there. So I just think I learned a lot about myself, about what I could do better myself. And you know, you talked about being Captain Serious before and shit like that. I still have that element to me, but I'm a bit more relaxed
heaps,
now.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And that's helped along the way too, I think. Yeah.
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 You've already segued me to the next bit anyway, which is kind of a skill that guests have when they can get you the next bit and I don't have to get us to the next bit. And you mentioned it, 9/11.
Yep.
So 2001,
yep,
which anyone watching at the time or clicking in on their telly that night will never forget what they saw. Were you at 10 News?
Yeah, I was, mate.
How did it turn out that you were there to start with?
I'd been doing some stuff for Sports Tonight, so I was doing reporting and various bits and pieces. I can recall reporting on John Hopewadi on
was this at the time of the famous Hopewadi?
Let's not go into that. So I did that at NRL headquarters and all sorts of things. But anyway, I was in there one night. We had just about wrapped up Sports Tonight, or the pre-production for it. Sandra Sully was at the host desk. She's doing the news, and I walked past an area of the newsroom that they call News Exchange. And that is effectively like a little room with huge banks of monitors, and there's feeds coming in from all around the world, you know, Reuters and might be CNN and all that sort of stuff. And invariably there's someone in there keeping an eye on all that stuff, and they can switch to it live, you can go and record it, you could do whatever back then, you know, on tape back then it was. And I walked past, and the guy who was running News Exchange, and he was quite ashen-faced, and I said, "What's up, mate?" And he said to me, "I think I just saw a plane go into the World Trade Center." And I said, "What?" And the producer who was looking after news for Sandra Sully was really good, straight onto it. And he'd gone to live pictures.
I remember watching this at the time. Yeah. On 10.
Sandra was excellent. So she starts ad-libbing and dealing with what's unfolding. My phone then rings. You've got to remember that everything's starting to clear out for the night. Most of the staff have started. It's only skeleton staff that are left. And the producer said to me, "Have you been watching this?" And I said, "Yes." He goes, "Start recording everything now." So I start recording everything and logging it, you know, just time codes for different things. And then the newsroom came alive again. People started coming back in. Jason Morrison came back in. And so a few of them came to me and said, "Have you watched all of this?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Right, we're going to do a bulletin at 6 a.m. in the morning with Ronnie Wilson, special one. We want you to do a story, a 5-minute encapsulation of everything that's unfolded."
Like if you've just woken up and have no idea what's unfolded.
Here's what's going on. So I start piecing that together. I work the whole night through. I can recall leaving a message on Murph's voicemail, saying, "Dude, you gotta get up. This is like World War III." And I rang my wife at the time, was in Korea, and so I can recall she was a couple of hours behind us. So I rang her as well and had a conversation with her because to me it was surreal, mate. Oh, I couldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I did the yarn. You know, we were, you know, thousands of k's away from where it really was unfolding. And years later, I went on in 2015, I think, or 2016, I went on a family holiday and went to you know, where Ground Zero now is and the memorial that's there, and one of the most moving things I've been to. Mm. Yeah.
Let's ramp it up a bit and get back into things. Yep. I know we've gone to some some sad stuff. But how on earth did Rusty's Garage start? Now, look, normally a podcast doesn't plug or mention another podcast, but that's not us.
Okay.
How is it that you end up doing a podcast before anybody else comes along and does a podcast? To become, let's face it, the preeminent automotive podcast of Australia.
I love it, mate. The genesis for it was probably in some, which you were involved in some conversations I had at Fox in 2017. They wanted long-form interviews for Inside Supercars, so I did one with Scotty McLaughlin, one with Craig Lowndes, one with Marcus Ambrose. I'm missing someone there.
I think I did a couple too.
We shared them.
Correct.
But they were
long form, but not long form.
No,
they were probably 15, 20 minutes, maybe.
But I mean, they often got cut down to 7, 8 minutes.
But we got some great stuff.
And I loved doing that. And at the time, I had started to have some conversations with a podcast house or Podcast One that they were looking for something automotive or racer based. We workshopped it, whiteboards and ideas and. Anyway, so we went away and said, let's record one and see what happens. So my first experiment was Molly Taylor. So we sat down.
Molly Taylor was a guinea pig for Rusty's Garage.
So we must have sat down, mate. I owe her massively. We must have sat down for 2 or 3 hours in Sydney at a studio and had a fantastic conversation, left it at that, walked away, pulled it to bits. That worked, that didn't work, blah, 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 blah. And then I went back and recorded it with her again.
Oh.
But I changed it up. I went to where their family live in Sydney. Her dad loves cars, mate. He's a rally driver and he's got some great things in the shed, some funky stuff too. And she and her mum own an Audi Quattro that used to be owned by Kerry Packer.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Packer, I think, saw it at the motor show at the time and said, "How much for that?" You know,
I'll have six.
Exactly. And they said, "No, Mr. Packer, it's not for sale. It's got to go back to Germany." Yeah, how much? You know, and it stayed. It stayed. So they own that car. So I thought, what better way to do it than go out and do the chat in amongst the cars? And away it went, and it was terrific. So, as you and I sit here, mate, it's just about to turn 2 years old. It has probably a racer skew at times because of what you and I love. But the thing that it, coming back to the Fox example, I loved unmasking the athlete a bit or unmasking the driver and tapping into the common thing, which you do so well here at Sleuth headquarters, mate, and that is the great cars over history or the cars that they have or bikes that they have, good or bad, been with.
Plenty of shitters.
Plenty of shitters. Plenty of things that have gone wrong with them and talking about some of that stuff. So it is, for me, as much a human thing as about the car or bike as well.
Has it been a good outlet? Obviously, the television stuff changed in your world.
Yep.
So you could sink your teeth into this a bit harder because, A, it's yours, which is always handy.
Yep.
B, your world changed. But it gives you that flexibility. I mean, one of the things I find difficult in my world here, and I'm interested in your take, is when you're running, in essence, I run a business. It's not just me here. There's other people here as well. So I find myself spending more and more time running the business, doing the deals, wheeling and dealing, all that sort of stuff. But to do the actual sit-down chats is now even better than it's ever been.
So
because
rewarding.
It's the only thing I get to do that is, for want of a better term, content creation. Mm. I don't get to do much of it anymore. So when we do get to do it, it's actually really nice because it's the 5% of everything else that's all not the tough yards, but the stuff that you would rather not be doing. You'd rather be doing this all the time. But how's it been in your world?
We're in sync here, mate, because it's the two things. A, it's immensely rewarding, and B, it's yours, right? Mm. So, media in the levels that you and I have played with, either at network or sport or whatever, it takes an army of people. These things are a small group, you and Will, or if there's a bit of production involved in the background, it's the same for me. It's a very small, tight team, and I like that. I do everything from, writing the intros and voicing them. I've got a little voiceover setup that I use for that. I love the input, and the two guys that I work with behind the scenes are into it as much as I am, so that helps immensely. And we're always thinking of people to go and speak to, and it's funny how it changes. The first I don't know, six or so episodes, you know, I was like, can I get you to come on? Can I get you to come on? And now it's 180,
everyone's,
you know,
going everyone, the other way.
which is great. And lots of feedback from listeners too, wanting, you know, people that you mightn't expect. And it's, as you have come to understand here, because you do such a good job of it, it's not always the champions. The champions have that lure because of what they've achieved, but it's often the good storytellers, mate, and the things they've, you know, you can unlock with them.
Yeah, the people who people might not really know, or know, they vaguely know the person, but they don't know the story. Whereas with some of the big names, you've kind of heard everything there is to hear. So yeah, between us and all the other ones out there, there's still a whole pile of paddocks
heaps,
for us to mow through and search. But let's just talk before we go and double up on anybody, right, shall we?
Who got this week?
Hey, one of the things I wanted to check with you too, and I've deliberately not asked you about some of these things in the last 6 to 12 months because I wanted to save them all up for here. And that's not to launch them upon you, but it's more to have the chat here rather than try to do it twice over. In 2006, Channel 10 finished up with the rights to supercars, and Channel 7 came back on the landscape for 2007, which also at the same time saw the introduction of what was then called V8 Supercar Television. I think it's now technically known as Supercars Media.
Yep.
That is the arm within Supercars that produces the broadcasts at the moment for Fox Sports and Network 10, previously for Channel 7.
Yep.
Am I right or wrong? You turned down a deal to go with 7 in 07.
I have the contract to this day. I have the paperwork. I've kept it.
So you know I need to thank you here.
That's good, mate.
Because you didn't go, and that gave me a gig.
Well, and similarly, we probably both need to thank David White, because what David White did for me was to give me great opportunity with MotoGP, with Formula One, and then even when D-Dub left and David Barham came, I mean, I got to do Com Games and Winter Olympics and things. So if I'd gone, maybe I wouldn't have had that opportunity. Mm-hmm.
So I ended up calling supports and did a little bit of pit lane because Grant Denyer went to race. Who did he drive for in the Enduros? WPS.
Yep.
So he picked up a deal there. So that took him out for the Enduros, and it put a very lanky, young, silly Ballarat boy in the lane. So two Ballarat people, Crompton and I both, we actually figured out in the last year or two, his mum lives 5 minutes from my mum and dad. It took us all these years to figure it out. It's silly, isn't it? So that was the gig you turned down.
I did. Yeah. And it was, I'd have to go back and look at it, but largely what you're describing, mainly pit reporting. I had, by the time, you know, that whole period through to the end of 06, I was sort of cemented there and really, really enjoyed that stuff. And it expanded into sort of Gold Coast Indy and
so did you go close? Did you go close to going?
Yeah, I did. I did.
How
I mean,
close?
I was very uncomfortable having conversations about it. I just didn't think that was – I didn't have an agent then, so I didn't like that side of it. I'd rather just
You're busy working for one mob, but you're talking to the other about the next step.
I'm by and large a loyal guy, you know, and so my loyalty was torn there because, you know, you'd go to whatever. This is hypothetical. I can't remember, but you'd go to Supercars headquarters to do a story because you're still in the midst of what you're doing for Channel 10, and people are wanting to talk to you about, hey, do you want to come next year? And I was very – I didn't like that. But the loyalty is split, Aaron, because on the one half, I – the people in that Supercars paddock, I considered family. The constituents, I felt like family. So part of me was like, I don't want to miss that. But at the same time, what David offered me was too good to knock back. It was hard to begin with. I can remember getting a message from someone at Adelaide in 07. And, you know, RPM still existed back then and we were chasing different yarns. But you felt a little bit
one out, one wide,
as far as Supercars was concerned. But what David very cleverly did was do things where we would go to international Formula One or MotoGP races, and you ended up doing things that, in a career sense, were better for you. And he gave you a chance to go. I mean, I went to the British Grand Prix, mate. I loved,
which you wouldn't have been able to do if you were doing the other things. So it swings around.
It was meant to be stuff.
Caber tossing never came under the radar.
I have commentated some caber tossing.
What?
Not for television.
If it's not for television, no. What's it for?
It's over the PA. Keep going.
Right, okay. Yes. Oh, I thought I had a nugget.
No.
Nuggets, I know you've spoken about Barry Sheen with Billy Woods on your podcast.
Yeah.
Is there a Barry story or something else that you might not have wheeled out somewhere along the line?
Sugar. He was an unbelievable human being, mate. He
could get away with anything.
He could get away with anything. I think I recounted it with Billy, so forgive me if I'm telling the story again for your audience. But we drove into the Adelaide 500 one day, and he goes, Baz was big on getting as close as he could to where he had to. He didn't want to walk miles and didn't want to do walking.
Well, when your legs have been so badly busted in motorbikes over the years, that's fair call.
First time I ever met him, when I went to his house, he tries to come in the office. So I go into the office, and he had a metal boot, and he just upended it, and all these screws and bolts and plates and everything came out, and he goes, that was all what was inside me, kind of thing. You know, it's like it was like this, and he kept it all. And around in his house, he didn't really have much in the way of artwork. He had pictures. It was all pictures of things from his life and time, racing and friends and George Harrison and, you know, people like that, and he'd kept some cool bikes from his time. And some of those are being restored, actually, at the moment, they're, which I think is terrific to preserve all that stuff. But anyway, he was amazing. We drove into Adelaide, and, you know, you can go underneath the main straight, and you can pop up behind the pit garages, excuse me. And on that side of it, there is some exclusive parking from Premier to Tony Cochran to whoever it was back then, you know.
Bigwig. You got to be bigwig, yeah.
So he just motors in and parks it straight in the Premier's spot and goes, he won't be here today. We'll be sweet, you know. So he would talk to my mum on the phone when we were driving back from a race meeting. Oh, hello, Anne. How are you, darling? You know, but just an amazing guy with what you got what you saw. We once, mate, I don't know if I've ever told this story. We were at Bathurst one year and it was Sunday night and Baz loved to laugh, but there must have been a line. Diff started chucking everything on Baz's hotel bill. Right?
Oh, no.
So on the Monday, Baz goes to check out, and it's, you know, insane the number. And he knew straight away who it was, and he came up and he collared him, and he goes, "I'm all for a laugh, but that's going too far." And Diff was kind of, you know, a bit, but, and then that was it, dude. There was nothing. He and Diff were best mates, that he just had his say and he got it off his chest. And that was it.
And paid the bill.
Yeah.
Did you segued me again without even trying?
Yeah.
Diffy.
Yeah.
Have we got a Diffy story? Wasn't there a remind me, was it a weekend at Ipswich? We were out there for a supercars round, and this is in the days. Where 10 were covering. He was still here before he went. No, he'd been away and come back. And didn't he go and do some dirt bike, celeb mini motorbike race, and he fell off and snapped his leg?
Bang on. So he was great mates with Phil Christensen, who ran the forerunner to what we now think of as the SX Open, Oz X Open. So Christo had a round of the Supercross Masters, it was back then in Brisbane, and he did that occasionally where they would coincide with a V8 round.
Makes
and then
sense.
On the Saturday night, a couple of the boys would go and they'd do a celebrity postie bike race or something stupid in there and ham it up and have some fun. And Daryl Beattie always used to whine Diff about his motorcycle riding. They'd known each other. I can't remember the club. I know it was Ipswich Club or wherever it was, but they used to ride together when they were youngsters, the pair of them. Daz won his first bike on Agro's Cartoon Connection. That's how that's how it all started for him.
Agro's still going.
And I've not asked him about it, but I think Daz has tracked that bike down too. So,
oh, really?
Which is really cool.
A bit of bike sleuthing.
So anyway, Diff, something really simple, like he was coming across a jump and he went to put his foot down to balance, you know, a potential fall, and it just snapped his leg, mate.
Ooh.
So he ends up in hospital. I don't think they were too impressed at 10.
Imagine
at
the phone
time.
Call.
Oh, it wasn't good. But luckily he had some painkiller on board, so I think that sort of...
The green whistle.
That's right. Flying. And anyway, I got shuffled the next day. Crompo and I ended up calling it together and it was very cool.
And no one was ever allowed to do a postie bike challenge.
I don't know if I better not say it. Baz did some funny commentary one day, and I can never remember if it got edited out or not. We were at Queensland Raceway, and someone someone in the center of the paperclip, I want to say, had late braked and absolutely gone straight up the back of the car in front.
I tell you, he's absolutely charging at the moment. Is Craig Lowndes. He went right back to 24th position. He's up to 7th. He has been absolutely storming through the pack.
Oh, yeah, up the inside of...
Greg Murphy.
Greg Murphy.
Former teammates, former Bathurst winners. Oh! That's called a sump in the rump, I think the Navy call it.
What up the rectum, don't affect him.
The producers and everyone were diving on the radio. Barry, can't say that! You know? And he was laughing. Oh, he was laughing.
I can imagine. Because the famous Lowndes Calder Park rollover, where Craig goes down on his head, what, 6, 7, 8 times. Yeah. Larry Perkins ends up checking out the underside of a HRT car. Commodore. And you can hear, he actually pulls himself up, Barry, from dropping a shit bomb on Channel 10 while Lowndes is barrel rolling down the road. It's probably, as much as the crash was a big crash, that's the bit that I probably remember, which is when you hang off the television coverage as a young bloke, it's those things that you remember that you can.
The commentary is so unique, mate, and probably couldn't be done anymore now. Now the way we're so informed with everything and people don't like necessarily the over sort of sell or overhype, but what Baz brought to it, mate. I mean, I often think now, he's been gone since 03, what would he be doing now? Would he be still being managed by Cocco? Would he be around supercars? Would he, you know, he's in his 60s, so what would he be doing? And he made it, we embraced him. He was very much a part of the supercars family. He used to do, I told this with Billy too, we had to do some international hostings because back then supercars were marketing it to all these different nations, some cutdowns. Mm. So Baz knew like 5 different languages. So he would go and we'd pick different drivers and they'd do it like a little opening hosting thing and off we'd go for highlights of Winton. And I reckon at Winton, he was with his good mate Russell Ingall and he was teaching Russell Portuguese or Spanish or something or other to, you know, hello and welcome and you know, this is Winton Supercars. And we were never sure whether he was saying, you know, and don't forget to wash your balls or something. you never knew what was going to wear, but it was awesome.
So that's part one of our chat with Greg Rust on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Timken. Now stay tuned for part two because he opens up about a major health scare he had back in 2011, plus the chance meeting it led to. And Rusty also tackles your National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions. And we put him up against the clock in our traditional Motor Focus Top 10 Shootout. If you're enjoying the V8 Sleuth podcast, make sure to leave us a review to help spread the word. And don't forget to subscribe to make sure that you don't miss any episodes as they come out. They'll be coming out almost every week throughout 2020, even as we bunker down amid COVID-19. Now, if you're looking for a bit of reading material at home, we're having a stock take sale in the V8 Sleuth online bookshop. If you haven't picked up a copy of Cars of the King or the Falcon Files or the illustrated history book of Ford at Bathurst or the official book of the 2018 Bathurst 1000 won by Craig Lowndes and Steve Richards, head to v8sleuth.com.au and click on bookshop to snap yourself up a bargain. And sign up too to the V8 Sleuth newsletter while you're at it. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram so you don't miss out on any new offers or products as they pop up. Until then, we'll catch you next time on the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Timken.